I am Joe Bendosky.
And I'm Jay Washburn.
And this is Start Writing. And today we are interviewing Amazon bestselling author Helen Hansen. Her book, Three Lies, was in the Amazon Top 100 and the number one in techno thrillers. It's part of a three-part series, and it is actually how I found her. I started reading it and just really enjoyed her writing, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. She writes most of her book in the techno thriller arena. For Source Material, she ran a software company, built video games, and opened many doors for her dogs. For fun, Helen flew a Mooney over the Golden Gate Bridge, traveled 100 miles per hour over the freeway, over Highway 17 to the coast, and annihilated an entire Cub Scout pack in laser tag. she can mimic the sounds of most farm animals.
Oh,
so this is Helen Hansen.
Hello, gentlemen. Very nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
So before we kind of get into anything, I want to kind of talk about Three Lies and kind of the why I am enjoying it so much and why I think every writer should read it and others of your work if they follow the same vein. This is first book of yours that I've read. In past episodes, we've talked about two types of writers, the clear window and the stained glass. Are you familiar with this metaphor, Helen?
I am now, yes.
Okay, yeah. And so I see her as very much a stained glass window writer, and that is one of the reasons I've really enjoyed her work, is she pushes language, particularly in her similes and her metaphors, in a way that is really unique and a lot of times comes up with just some really fantastic metaphors that you've never seen anywhere before. And so I recommend anyone who is serious about writing read her work because of the way she does that. It's very unique, and it's you know, they tend to work really well, and so I think it's just fantastic. You know, there are some, everybody has their genre they read just for entertainment, but as writers we kind of spread out and tap into other areas to kind of study craft and whatnot. So I do recommend reading her book, at least Three Lies, for just the craft emphasis and looking at how she deals with those metaphors and those similes, because they work really well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so I've actually got a few quotes we'll talk about later. Yeah. So one of the things we like to ask is, to help kind of see how you see your own writing and your own audience, is what is the book that's closest to yours? Like, you know, would you say it's more of a James Bond or a Jurassic Park? Like what is the really big hit that almost everybody's going to recognize that we'd say is the closest to your book, Three Lies?
I think it's hard for an author to be the one to designate that personally.
Huh.
I've been told I read like Clancy, but I don't feel like I'm anything.
No, I don't feel like you read like Clancy either.
Yeah, I mean, I want to know what kind of guns being used, but I don't want to know how to field strip it. I mean, he really gets into detail.
He does.
I do have a technological bent in every one of my books, and I think that's perhaps where the parallel comes from.
Huh.
I think I'm kind of a mix between Grisham and John le Carré in my own mind, but I don't know why that is either. So.
That's funny. I think I read Jeffrey Deaver. I've read a couple of his, and I would say you're fairly comparable to him. You know, you're not drowning me with an info dump on everything like Clancy does, which I don't like in Clancy's writing. I just feel like he
makes great movies though, doesn't he?
Yeah, they do make great movies because you don't get two
video games.
Yeah. You don't get two pages of, you know, what the gun looks like in the movie. It's just there. So
Helen, you said you don't know why you picked those two authors, maybe, but I'd like to push you a little. Like, are there certain aspects that you really love from those two authors that you feel like you've embodied or emulated or maybe even surpassed in some ways?
John le Carré is the one I fell in love with in terms of the spy genre. And for me, when you mentioned James Bond, I kind of giggled because those characters like a James Bond or a Jason Bourne are, to me, unrealistic. I mean, there may be one or two of them out there, and I enjoy reading about them or watching movies about them, but I can't write them. I can't relate to them personally. I like the people who are put into a situation that they can't deal with in an extraordinary way, and they have to use the tools at their disposal. And all the people I write about have, you know, technical skills that they draw upon to, you know, have them meet the challenge. What I loved about Le Carré was he gave us George Smiley, who was the antithesis of a James Bond. He was the, you know, what a real spy is, somebody who's nondescript. He's, you know, worried about his wife sleeping with somebody else, and he's just not the kind of guy that comes across as dashing and daring. He's, you know, frumpy and wears an overcoat that's probably stained. I love that about Le Carré.
Yeah.
He made it realistic. And Grisham was the guy who made me think I could write, believe it or not.
Huh.
at least fiction, because I've been writing for years. But he made me. I read his books and I go, well, I could do that. Clearly, I think every writer has that moment. But I liked his humor. I liked his everyday characters. I don't necessarily write legal thrillers, although you know, Three Lives has some legal aspects of it. But between those two, they've kind of been an inspiration to me personally, but I don't necessarily write like either one of them.
No, I like what you said. So did Grisham seem particularly, like what was it about his writing that made you think you could do it, or that you felt like you could do what he's doing?
He's not, he examines characters in a way that I enjoy. He also has employed humor in some of his books that, other writers don't necessarily, at least maybe I see it. He's also not an author who is so overwhelmed by the language. Some people just, I don't know, they kind of take themselves too seriously when they write, and they'll say something and they'll say it 53 times, and after the third time, I'm like, I get it.
Yeah.
Can you move on? And I find a lot of literary works are like that, and I read them, as you mentioned earlier, for kind of broadening my own horizons, but it's not my go-to. I much prefer an action story over one that's overly introspective. But that said, I think my characters tend to be a little more introspective than most thrillers. That may not be true either, but that's my impression.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's cool. I love that you focus on that. I really appreciate that in stories. That's awesome.
So kind of in the same vein, what is a book, like just any book that you've read that you wish you had written, that you read it and just...
The Martian.
The Martian?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, everything about that, it's smart, it's funny, it's hopeful, it's technologically accurate, except for minor places, you know?
Right.
It's just a fabulous book.
It is. I love The Martian.
It's just got it all. and it made a ton of money, let's face it. That's another compelling aspect of why I wish I'd written that one. But it's a great book, as well as a movie.
So, yeah,
it's,
I mean,
as well as a book.
It is the ultimate in the indie world, I think, because it started out completely free just on his blog. And then, you know, from there went on to just snag everything. It is the end all of everything indie authors want for their books.
Well, and it's such a wonderful character examination. I mean, somebody being put in that kind of a situation who has to draw upon his resources. Now, he's not, you know, an average person, perhaps, because he's got his botany skills and he's a scientist and he happens to be on Mars. But it was fascinating. Everything he went through, you know, it was one problem after another. It was fabulous.
Yeah, it was.
Agreed.
Agreed. Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you read it?
And it was still...
Oh, I loved it.
And it was funny and... you know, and hopeful. I'm tired of bleak books. I love John le Carré, but he ended up getting a little too world-weary for me at this stage of my life. And he kind of tends not to be quite as hopeful, and so I gravitate more towards those books nowadays.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I may have mentioned this somewhere in our emails, but our the big emphasis of our podcast is to talk about craft and to help writers find ways to kind of improve their own writing craft. And so I wanted to ask you, like, what do you consider, like, your best strength in your writing, and how did you develop that? And then on the reverse side, what do you consider some of your weaker aspects, and how do you work to develop those? Particularly because I read a lot of writers, and you write very well compared to a lot of writers that are out there.
Well, thank you. That's Three Lives was actually my first book. It's been a few years ago that I wrote this. I think in some ways, it was a test bed for me personally. It wasn't the first one I wrote, I shouldn't say. It was the first one I published. Like many authors, I have that novel that will never see the light of
day.
But this one was the first one I personally believed in. And I think one of my strengths is I'm an observer of people, and I'm pretty visual when it comes to my own thoughts. So I kind of visualize things before I write them. And but I also research a lot. I mean, when I put something in my book, I go to great pains to make sure that it's accurate. That might be also one of my problems as a writer, because I take too much time fussing around with research sometimes and don't spend enough time writing. And I'll research things that end up not being used in the book. And, right. You know, and then there's that occasional moment where you find that shiny thing that you just pursued that really isn't going anywhere. It's like, oh, wait, what was I here for? Oh, right, I need to get back to my work. But I do, I observe a lot. I observe people a lot. I'm a good people watcher. But I also put my own self in someone's head when I write that character. I use what they call very close personal point of view, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
When I, even though it's third person, I try and write it as if it were first person, but without, you know, using that convention.
Right.
Is there a reason that you tend to do that rather than just doing first person?
Because I find first person a little annoying. I mean, when I pick up a book and it's first person, I tend to go, okay, all right, do I really want to do this? Because you're only with that person the whole way through the book, or through that section of the book. And I read them. It's just not my preferred.
Yeah.
And I use multiple points of view throughout the book, so unless I was going to keep moving around from one eye to the next, it didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Right. Cool.
And so what do you consider an area that you're really working on and developing in your writing, and how do you go about that?
For me right now, it's really the production. I mean, I feel like I just want to go faster as opposed to, in terms of the craft, I try to read outside of my genre, like you say. If I find somebody who's really well-known, I read a book just recently, it was a woman's, an African-American woman from, like, the 30s. I forget her name now, Houston. I mean, it's a classic among, you know, African-American studies. I'd never read it before. It was a fabulous story. It was a woman kind of coming of age in a time when, you know, it was after Civil War, of course, but before, you know, civil rights. And it was just her place in that world. And it was a great story of her, you know, struggling to, with the men in her life, and, you know, being recognized as an individual. It wasn't the big feminist song. It was kind of a feminist song at the time, perhaps, but I didn't really look at it that way. It was just a woman's struggle, and it was fabulous. It was really well written. So, and the language was lyrical all the way through. It's not the kind of thing that I would necessarily put in one of my books, but it just gives you another color on the palette, so to speak, to draw from. You speak about some of my metaphors and things. Some people don't like them. I kind of figure I'm an acquired taste, as I am in real life. But some people think, I had a lady ask me if I even spoke English as a first language.
Whoa.
Annoying.
Dang.
That's funny.
And I said, well, I do, but, you know, sir, you know, everybody's got their own touch points. But for me, it was, you know, you have to be true to the voice that you have. I think that's probably what this book is. It was the first book where my voice was true to what I wanted to accomplish. Whereas everything else was kind of throat clearing, perhaps.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think this is a statement I make a lot about stained glass writers, is that because they push and challenge language so much, sometimes little weird things come out. You know, there's a sentence or a metaphor that comes out, and it's really like, what in the world? But among that, there's also the incredible pieces and metaphors that are so fantastic. They get used by everybody because they're so good that they eventually become the cliches. Like, you know, clear as crystal.
Yeah.
A stained glass writer came up with that. And everybody who read that said, that is the best description of that I've ever heard. I'm using it. until it became a cliche. And so that's kind of, you know, so I see that in your writing. You know, I'll talk about some of these quotes that, you know, there will be weird things that come out because stained glass writers push language further than anyone
right.
else. But in that, though.
Well, and some people will enjoy them and some people will go, all right, that was
yeah.
interesting, but, you know, not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is that years ago when I was a less confident writer, shall we say, I would try and imagine that next clear as crystal kind of simile.
Right. Huh.
And I had a hard time doing it because they were all done. I mean, how do you improve on that? And but that's when you start kind of going beyond what the convention is and saying, okay, well, but how do I want to do it? I don't care how other people have done it in the past. How do I want to do it? How would I express that? And I kind of gave myself permission to just write.
Hey, so I'd like to go back. You mentioned that you would like to increase the volume of your writing. What tactics are you employing or planning to employ to try to make that happen?
Honestly, I've had a couple of busy years personally, and I'm liking to think that those things are not in my way anymore. Without going into a lot of details, just a lot of stuff's been going on
yeah.
personally, and it's been very distracting and. You know, life happens, and so I'm hoping that that's something that I can say, okay, I'm good now, let's move on, let's focus on this part of my life. We'll see. I'm not one of these that feels like I have to, you know, accomplish certain things in my life in order to be happy. It either is there with me along the way, or it's never going to happen, so. But it's a goal of mine, to be a little more productive.
Do you set goals for when you want to finish drafts and when you want to publish and stuff like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But we're at the end of the year and the book I have on the deck right now is not done yet. So there you go. But hey, New Year's resolution.
Yeah.
So I found in my own writing that as the more I've studied craft and worked to improve how I write, I find that I write slower because of it. Like when my writing was abominable, I could crank it out at a great pace. And then, you know, I went back and I joined critique groups and I read books about writing craft and I really learned how to do it. And now I write much, much slower.
That's good though. I think it's a worthy trade-off.
I think each writer has their own natural rhythm too. I mean, you look at somebody like, the lady who wrote, was it the one book, right? And then she had to come out with a sequel.
Oh, I
know. I can't remember.
So I think.
Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she wrote a lot of other stuff, but one book. I mean, if we all wrote that one book, we'd probably be a little worried about trying to do a sequel too.
Yeah.
But you know, that's one end of the spectrum, and then you've got Stephen King. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I know people who would read his grocery list. So.
Yeah, I've heard some of these indie authors just crank at obscene paces. Like I've heard authors who do like 4,000 words an hour, and like they just they're turning out a book a month, and I'm just like, wow, that's unreal.
That's crazy.
That is unreal.
Yeah, particularly in certain genres like romance. I mean, those people just devour books. You know, thrillers are probably a close second, I guess. Maybe not quite as close, but
yeah. I think you're right. They're probably the second biggest share, but romance is over 50% of the market.
Yeah. I don't get it, but there it is.
So. Yeah. So in this vein of writing, do you use a content editor? Like, do you send like an outline to anybody or a first draft and say, let's look at the plot and characters and arc? Or do you just kind of ferret that out on your own?
Oh, no, that's purely me.
Okay.
I end up honestly changing it halfway through the book most of the time. In fact, I did that today. I completely changed what some characters were going to do and how something was going to end because I like to write books with some kind of surprise at the end.
Mm.
And if they're not surprising me along the way, I have to change it. So
are you a panster?
It's ironic because I am just the biggest nerd planner in my life until it comes to writing, and I like to think I am, but I have to force myself to plan because it's too hard for me. I don't know why. And so maybe that's my biggest challenge as a writer, is to be a better planner. But I'll write down something and I'll think, okay, that's it, that's my book, and then I'll get partway through it and go, I don't like that, and I'll change, I'm someone who really does try to outline, but probably doesn't do it well enough yet. So we'll see. I kind of came up with my own outlining methodology for the way I write books, and this is the first book I've tried it on, but I tried it about midway through, so we'll see if it works on the next one.
Do you have any comments to make about that methodology?
Well, it's kind of looking behind the curtain, so maybe not.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
It's basically, I like woven threads. I like several threads of a story. And I like them to not necessarily look like they're relevant to one another at the beginning of a book. I like to read. And as you weave them together, suddenly you've got this braid that looks kind of nice, and at the end of it, it's all tied together with something. And that's how I look at my books nowadays, very specifically.
So I
did was identify what those threads are more definitively. More specifically.
So, I can definitely see that in the book Three Lies. Like, it might be some little spoilers here for anyone who doesn't want to get that. But so you have Clint, who's this guy who he's made his fortune in the tech industry, and he's just sick of it. He's done. And then his girlfriend gets kidnapped. And then you've got this stuff going on at the CIA, and like the two feel totally unconnected for several chapters. Like, you're just like, I don't know what's going on here. But eventually they start coming together at the end, and it all makes sense. But yeah, I definitely can see that in the book that I've been reading, is there's these two threads that you don't understand how they're connected, and it's really hard to make that leap. But eventually when all the pieces come together, it does work. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. It's hopefully people stick around for the convergence, but that's kind of how I like to read books. So here we are, rewriting them.
Yeah. Since you're an indie, we do kind of want to talk to you about your marketing, particularly since you've been a very successful indie. And I feel like marketing is half of the business there. So what are some of the things that you've done that have worked for you?
That's what I'm working on. I think collaboration is a good thing when it's with other authors and different promotions, when it's genre specific and when it's something that doesn't encompass too much of your resources. I mean, time and whatnot.
Right.
I've been in some groups that I love the people dearly, but just the amount of time I put into them really didn't work for me, so I had to back out. I certainly believe in an email list. I've got some great readers, people in my mailing list who are real champions of my work and are real cheerleaders too, which is nice. Yeah. It's one of those days where things aren't going well and you get a comment from somebody and it's like, okay, thanks. I forget, this isn't all about me. It's about people who are out there reading as well.
All right.
Yeah, you had mentioned earlier about BookBub. It's a great gig if you can get it. I've gotten it before, and it's always wonderful.
I think
there's other venues too.
Yeah.
Are any of your fans on your beta readers list?
I was going to ask that exact question.
I've been involved in a couple of critique groups for many years. We meet once a month locally, and these are very dear people to me. And several of them are my beta readers. They've read all my books. Some of them aren't. We'll get people off the street, who come in once for a meeting and, that we'll never see them again. Beta readers that I rely heavily on. They know my voice. They appreciate my genre. I mean, you don't want to listen to somebody who doesn't read your genre. It's just kind of basic.
Yeah.
But they also know my accesses and, are able to reel me back in on certain areas. I've had certain things that I just loved, but when, six people out of seven don't get it,
That's the worst. That is the worst. When you're like, this is so good, and nobody gets it. And like, dang it.
Yeah. I've had some great lines. I'm like, all right, forget it. This isn't the right crowd. Whatever.
Yeah.
But you write to please yourself first, but before it goes out the door, you want to make sure you're not the only one.
Right, yep.
Appreciates it. But I will take the opinion of somebody who reads thrillers over somebody who doesn't. Guaranteed. Any day. I'm working on, but all my characters are in the same story world.
Oh, really?
They might pop up in some of the other books. I actually read that years ago with Scott Turow, Presumed Innocent. His books are too gritty for me. He's a fabulous writer, but they're a little too raw. Huh. And it stopped me from reading about five of them. But he will have a minor character, and in the next book, it's the main character. I just found that really interesting. So I kind of lifted that idea from him.
Huh.
In all of my books, there might be one of the, you know, some character who's in one of the other series, even though they aren't the main character in this one. That was a bit of a tangent, but
oh, I think that's brilliant. Like as I'm thinking about this idea, like, because so much goes into the development of your central characters. They're really in depth. They've got a lot of backstory. And if you can pull one of them or two or three to be minor characters in this another story, then you know those minor characters have all that depth and that voice development already done.
Yep.
I mean, that's a fantastic idea. I think that's probably going to be the best piece of this podcast, is that idea right there.
That's genius.
It's been fun using them because they pop up, they do their thing, and then they leave. But, you know, you get maybe a little snippet of what was going on from, you know, the book they were in. But otherwise, they do their thing and they're gone. The whole notion of glass stained and otherwise, I had heard this years ago, and it kind of ties into some of the other stuff we're going to discuss. But the whole notion of backstory. So many, young writers or novice writers, however you want to call them, they'll put this info dump.
Mm-hmm.
You got to, three pages of this before we find out that there's a dead body around the corner, which is what we all really want to get to. So I've heard the analogy, and I can't give credit where it's due, but was to take all of the stuff that you think is important for backstory and put it on a piece of glass. Actually, put about half of it on a piece of glass, and then take the glass and shatter it. And then take those shards and put them in your story throughout, as opposed to, as that single pane of glass. And that to me is a real visual thing that I do intentionally in my book. And one of the things that my beta readers do is help me keep those info dumps from happening, because some of the stuff I write about is very technical. My book, Ocean of Fear, I talk about navigating underwater subs remotely, or not remotely, independently via computer programs. You know, they're self-operated, they're robots, essentially. And that was some stuff I had to go study, but I wanted to give enough information that people who hadn't done the study I had could understand it, but not so much that it put them to sleep.
Yeah, so that's the balance.
It is. It's a real balance. And to me, Clancy goes overboard for my personal taste, but other people just eat it up.
Yeah.
So, I
agree. For my taste, he is overboard on the info dumps. But yeah, it's a fine balance, enough so that people can connect and understand, but not to where they just like their eyes blur and be like, okay, I don't want to know anymore.
Right. Did you read was it Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand?
I did.
Oh, yeah.
It was a good book. Okay. Did you see that speech coming from his face, like a mile away? And when they got there, it was like 50 pages. John Galt.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a 50-page speech.
That's so
funny. And I just went, I licked my finger and went, flip, 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 until we got to the end of it.
I think,
I know what he's going to say.
The whole book, everybody does these huge speeches that span pages. Nobody else gets to talk. This speech just goes off. Like, that's the whole book. It's really weird.
They kept telegraphing that thing, and I thought, my goodness, with all this, all this build-up, it's going to be a long one, so I was prepared. But it's a classic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, still, she found her market.
She did. She found her market. And, that is the difference between a best-selling writer and a great writer. A great writer can write well. A best-selling writer finds their market.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'd be happy with being a best-selling writer. younger writers. I think it's important you find critics.
Good. I like where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Keep going, yeah.
I think it's important you find people who like your voice, who believe in your ability, but aren't gonna just let you write, let you get lazy. I love about the people I've been working with for so many years is they'll say, yeah, you can do something better than that here, or, you know, or my content, one of my main content editors, she'll say, I skimmed this part. It was really well written, but I kind of skimmed it. Because she's not technical. She finds some of that stuff just too much, but she likes the story.
Do you tend to give your book to your readers by chapter, or do you tend to give the whole book, like an entire draft, to them?
Good idea.
Well, yeah, no, only the whole draft. Because the way I work, it's not finished until I've personally gone through it. So I write it, and I already know the things I need to change by the time I'm done, and I go make those changes, and then I'll listen to it. I'll have it read to me.
Oh, cool.
And I'll make any changes that I need. Just based, I had one. It was three lines, in fact. Chester gestured. Until you hear that out loud, it doesn't, you know, doesn't quite click how
That's
bad
funny.
That is. So then once I've done that, then I'll give it to my beta readers.
Do you use a
computer? And then they'll give me their changes. And now, since I've got a group of people who are interested in my work, I'll pass it out to my. I guess those are my beta readers. My primary readers are my personal friends. And then I have now a group of people online who are my beta readers, and they will read it. And then when that is done, I consider it finished, if you will, with respect to the final editing.
Do you
go through a couple of processes?
Out of curiosity, do you read full manuscripts for some of these same people of their books?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you,
and like I say, I've known them for 10 years or more. So yes,
yeah,
a few of them I do.
You said you listen to the audio. Is that you just have a computer narrated, like generated talk? Yeah.
Yep. I have. I used to use a little piece of software called Read Text Aloud for years, but I've got. I also do some of the. Voice recognition now, and so that will read it to me as well. But I kind of prefer the less sophisticated, because I can clip and paste however much I want in there.
Oh, yeah.
It's just simple. It just helps me, pick out errors, inconsistencies.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I've never
tried that, and it sounds like a great idea.
It does sound like a really good idea, yeah.
It doesn't take long either. I mean, I could tend to speed it up a little faster than normal, so it reads quickly. Just gives me another check before it goes out to my beta readers.
Yeah,
I'm gonna look into that, actually. okay, I don't think I have any real big spoilers in any of the quotes I was gonna look at. Just for anyone listening who just wants to kind of go into the book raw, you might want to listen to this part of the interview later. So the one I actually want to start with is actually the last one on the list I have here. And so these are quotes that illustrate craft, and that's why I wanted to bring them up and discuss them. So it's not going to be like some inspirational quote you'd see like on Facebook or something. Those aren't the kind of quotes we're pulling from the book. We're pulling quotes that are illustrating craft. So this is the line, and it says, her teeth shined like the inside of a coconut. And when I read that line, I thought about people who whiten their teeth like constantly, so they're that really bright white. And then you've got the little bit of saliva on there that gives it that shine. And then I thought about when you crack open that coconut and it is that really bright white inside with that milk that gives it that glossy shine. I was like, that is just perfect. And the context of the quote doesn't actually include everything that makes it so good. And that this is a line about a girl named Natalie, and she has dark skin. And so added that to, you've got the coconut that is that dark color with that really bright inside. And so when it talked about, that's what her smile looked like, I was like, that is just perfect. I've never heard of anyone describing it that way, but for me, it was just perfect. And that's an example of a lot of the things that I see in your writing as this stained glass approach that, there are ones that, I think, oh, that didn't work out. That was really weird. But then there are ones like this that just, very unique, very well done, and really just breathe a lot of life into the image.
Thank you. Well, one of the things I've heard is that people of color, if you want to use that term, they don't like the way a lot of white writers describe them. And you know, one of the things I've noticed is that we don't describe white skin very often. I mean, I've made a point of doing that about some of my characters. You know, like the this isn't a more current book of mine. I describe it as that tint that's unique to the Irish, because we have very different color skin as well.
Yeah, I like
just,
that.
I do
know,
like
it's
that.
Not always, it's not often commented upon, and so I wanted to. In this case, it was a character I like a lot. You know, you'd asked about some of the characters I identify with. I like Natalie because she's just kind of a take charge, you know, let's get it done kind of person. And that was the way I was when I was in corporate. I wasn't a very good, what's the word? I can't think of a nice one, butt kisser. I mean, I can think of. I didn't play politics. I'm very task-oriented. When you take those personality tests, I'm in the 2% that's in there with George Patton. I'm a field marshal.
That's correct.
I want to get stuff done. And as one of my bosses said, either lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way. So if somebody's competent, is running things, I'm good. But if somebody incompetent isn't, I'm out. It's beyond me to deal with. So I like Natalie. That's a little bit of me in there, I guess, in that regard, because that was her, to a certain extent. But
Have you ever based a character on someone that you know closely, maybe tied the character really closely to that person?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, pieces of it. I mean, none of these characters are anybody in particular, but absolutely. I mean, you know, you get little snips of someone here and someone there, and suddenly you've got a whole new person.
You've never felt like you were getting in the danger zone because they were too similar to the real person?
Oh, no. No, I mean, only one. Well, maybe I should say this. I did write about one woman I just did not like years and years ago.
So was this in a book that got published or one that didn't?
Oh, it's actually in 3 lines.
Oh, was that Paige?
No, it was a minor character.
Okay.
It was somebody who was... she was a troublemaker. She's just one of these that like to stir it up just to see how it, other people, I don't know. I can never figure those people out. To me, it's like you're either rowing or you're not rowing, but, you know, you don't throw water in the boat just to do it. She's one of those people. And it's just, I could never figure them out. But, yeah, I had a character in there that it was kind of clear I didn't like her, and I used her name, and I thought, nah, I better not do that.
Change the name.
This was a long time ago. It wasn't like Mary. It was kind of a unique name, so I decided that was probably not a wise thing. But
that's funny.
She was the one who, she wasn't a horrible person in the book. She just wasn't somebody you felt compelled to like. It was kind of a juvenile moment, but that's all right. I'm allowed.
Yeah, I love it.
That's funny. So I wanted to ask you about the title, because... Like, what is it? I've heard people say that, particularly now, you sell a book based on cover, title, blurb, in that order. And so as I get reading lists from Goodreads and BookBub and Fussy Librarian, you know, I get tons of these emails every day that I skim through really quickly, you know, and if something catches my attention, I pick it up. And that's how I came across your book, and it was the title that got me, because I was looking... for an espionage thriller, and you know, the title, Three Lies, a Master CIA Thriller, like immediately I was like, that is the exact genre of the book I'm looking for. And so that's really what caught me, and it felt like reading the title, you had not tried to develop a real mysterious hook, but rather you had tried to identify the book by the genre so people could identify that really quickly and pick it up. So I was kind of curious how you chose the title and whatnot.
After probably 17 others.
Wow.
I like to say it was my first book, and I really didn't know what to call it. And I don't personally think I'm one of the better title makers out there. And at some point I just go, okay, that's it, I'm done. And in this particular case, it was because of all the research I had done on some of the you're familiar with the book, so the Statue of the Boston.
Oh, right.
Kind of stuck with me, so that's why I used it. But it also typified the genre as well as many of the aspects of the book. Somebody wrote me once, "Well, I only counted two lies." I'm like, okay, you got me.
That's great. Do you happen to remember any of the discarded titles?
Oh, gosh. Wow. I probably have them on disc somewhere.
Yeah. No, it's no big deal. I was just kind
of
curious.
Yeah, I don't know them off the top of my head.
Huh.
Along the lines of the title, who do you work with for your cover art? Or how? What is your input on that?
That was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah, that one was actually a company that isn't around anymore.
Oh.
So you're not working with the same artist each time?
I haven't in every case, no. Hmm.
So have you just never found anyone you really liked?
Well, I'm a little insecure about the covers, too, I'll be honest. Mm. I may have them all redone here soon, so I don't know.
Oh, cool.
But that one's probably my favorite.
Yeah,
I just love the picture of that guy.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I also, the image of the little girl in the crosshairs, I just feel like that's a really intense on Spider Games.
Right. Well, that's the third book. No, it's the second book in the Ocean of Fears series.
Okay.
That one. Well, she's key in the story.
Yeah.
I love that look on her face, though.
Yeah,
that's funny. When I was looking at your title and you know, looking at it compared to others, it to me, I remember listening to an interview with an author, I can't remember his name, but he talked about how he did a lot of Facebook ads for his marketing, and he was looking at writing another book, and so he did two things. He said, well, I've got several ideas for several different books. So he took all of those ideas and made Facebook ads and tested them to see which idea worked the best. And then he went and he tried several titles again the same way. There was no book or anything. He just wanted to see what title and what idea worked the best in his advertising. And then based on that, he wrote and titled his book. And so I kind of had that feeling from your title. So.
Interesting. No, I'm not nearly that methodical. That would actually make sense.
So it's kind of brilliant if you've got, you know, the patience and the willingness. I think I would have a hard time if I didn't really like the title that Facebook liked. I think I'd have a hard time committing.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have that much patience either, though. So did it work out, you know?
Yeah, I heard that it did, said that it had done really well, particularly because, I mean, he'd tested everything before he even wrote the book. So he knew that it was going to, you know, particularly when dealing with, you know, ebooks at, you know, $2, $3.99, it's almost an impulse buy. Like I said, you know, title, cover, blurb, and that's what had been tested in Facebook, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he already knew he was going to do really well in the sales department because that's what was tested.
That's sweet.
No, it is. It's really quite cunning. Although I feel bad for the people who click on it and it like goes nowhere, right? Because it doesn't exist yet.
He may be using up some goodwill there for the actual sale.
Yeah. So all the people who clicked on it in your testing phase won't click on it again because they're like, hey, it doesn't exist. It's not real.
Yeah. I fell for this one. I don't think so.
So here's another quote I wanted to kind of discuss with you. And so I saw this specific element of craft in your book a lot. And we actually did a whole discussion on action beats that we're actually releasing in December. And so in it, I'll read it here. It says, what's the ETA? Albert pulled on his fleshy earlobe. And so here we have an action beat, but on the tail end of it, you've gone beyond just the action beat of him pulling on his earlobe, and you've mentioned the word fleshy, and it just adds a little more detail to the character and fleshes him out a little bit more. And so the element here is going beyond the beat and taking an opportunity to fill in more detail of the characters or remind the reader. And so again, it was something I saw you do several times, and it was actually in reading your book that I really got thinking about that and how well it can work in writing.
That's one of the things where I take one of those little shards I was talking about and just place it in there. Because it's a good place to do it. I've listened to some audio books, and they're by really well-known, very well, you know, well-selling authors. And I get tired of hearing he said, she said,
yeah.
Jack said. And I've always been a little less likely to put them in, the attributions. And I've had, you know, my readers go, okay, we don't know who's reading here, put something in. We don't know who's talking here, put something in. And so I try to do action beats as much as possible. I have nothing against he said, she said, but I really do make a point to do it as little as possible. For that very reason, to always have some kind of an interesting activity take place, or in this case, we get to know a little bit about Albert.
Yeah, yeah, just a little more detail on his character beyond what we had before. I really liked it. And like I said, I think I've got another quote or two in here that just illustrates that same point. But all of them, you know, I thought were, you know, it was done really well, and just, you know, adding a little bit more to the characters, a little more depth each time it happened. So this is, all of this is from Three Lies. And so here's the line, and I really like the way you described it here. It said, he entered a particularly dense copse for cover and leaned against the sugar maple until his jumpy skin stilled. And his jumpy skin stilled. I was like, that is, I've never heard anyone describe it that way, but I knew exactly what you meant. I knew the exact feeling on my own skin. I was like, that was just, it was concise, it was effective, it was unique, and it was very well done.
Well, in this case, it's the guy on the cover.
Right, yeah.
And he was doing some recon. And, you know, we tend to think of professionals as not being afraid, but they are. I mean, they're human.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what they say about heroes, it's the person who's afraid and did it anyway. And I like to get in their heads, regardless of whether they're good guys, bad guys, you know, doing something noble or doing something illegal, and trying to imagine how I would feel, you know, what would it be like? And in certain cases, not even how I would feel, but how would only they feel,
mm-hmm.
because of their unique characteristics and makeup. And in this case, he didn't want to be there. It wasn't their mission he believed in. So,
right.
You know, when things went awry, it not only reaffirmed his suspicions, but made him angry. But yeah, I remember writing that one. Scene was one of my favorites.
Huh. What's a strange or unique part of your writing ritual?
I'm not sure I have one. I mean, yeah. I like to be comfortable. I like to be in my cozy chair and have something drink nearby, and I like to have my doors closed so nobody can interrupt me. I chew gum loudly.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, I'm talking really snapping loud. Everybody in my family, my husband and son have veto power. If I have gum and I start saying, "Mom, you're snapping. Son, you're out. You're done." But in here, I can do that as loudly as I want. And sometimes it gets just kind of raucous.
That's funny.
It's not a nice habit, perhaps, but there's something soothing about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I like it. Do you listen to music, certain type of music?
No, can't do it.
Really?
Silence.
No. In fact, when I was in college, I could not listen to any music that had lyrics, because I hear them. Whether I want to or not, I hear them. And so even the lyrical stuff tends to get me thinking elsewhere. So no, I can't do music at all. But especially anything with lyrics. I mean, I'll be singing along, and I mean, I have one of those. I'm one of those people that get, they call them earworms. I've only recently heard that term. Where I'll get a song stuck on my head. And
oh yeah, me too.
It's not even one I like necessarily.
Yeah.
It's one I know the lyrics to, and it's just, I mean, it'll consume me for a week. I mean, what you should do is kill me when, well, bad pun, but when Bowie died, when you know. Probably a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it kind of goes with the turf this particular year. There were so many musicians. But yeah, so no, I can't do lyrics at all.
Hmm.
Whereas my husband cannot hear them. I'm like, you don't hear that? like, that's the nastiest song. Oh, I have no idea, you know. And I'll hear some of these rap songs out in the middle of the grocery store. It's like, seriously, people? Do you know what's on there?
That's funny.
But it's kind of a curse. I kind of wish I didn't have that in some ways, but it's good for trivia night. That's about it.
I just remembered, this isn't my final question, but I remembered the end of your author bio said you can imitate farm animals. I don't know if you dare, but this is an audio format.
I could do one, perhaps. I don't want to do all of them.
Okay.
Well, which animal would you prefer?
I would say, which is the most impressive at a party? Like...
I don't know. I'm not sure that works anymore. Here, I'll do it. Let me see here. I could do a cow. Let's see.
What? Whoa, that's crazy good.
Dead on. Wow, that is crazy good.
Wow.
Thank you. Yeah. It's one of my lesser talents.
That's so cool. Thank you.
I write those bios, and they're all so boring. You know, I love chocolate, and I love to take walks in the park. And after a while, it's like, come on. Well, you know, you got to start picking out some of the things that are just a little more interesting.
You nailed it.
I really do steal ink pens. when I was working, I'd end up with like 15 of them. Like, all right, sorry guys, who's this? I'd walk around saying, okay, is this yours? Is this yours?
That's funny.
Okay, and then last question. Thinking back, you know, maybe 10, 15 years, what advice would you give your amateur self?
Oh, God, that's a good question.
My amateur self?
Yeah, as you're starting out as a writer, what would have been something good to know?
Don't listen to the people who tell you it's hard. Don't listen to the people who, don't listen to everybody else's struggles. You know, you just go do it. I mean, it's like anything else. You got to put one foot in front of the other. And yeah, there's going to be times when you land on your face and, you know, pick yourself up, move on. Did you read the dedication in three lines? It's to Michael, who kept quiet when he didn't believe I could write a novel. That's my husband.
That's beautiful.
I mean, he knew I was a good writer because I wrote technical things for many years. I managed operations for companies that made video games, that made computers, made all kinds of things. But he didn't really think I could, you know, write fiction, because when I tell a story, I have to really think about it to make sure you get all the elements, and all the element order, and not get the punchline. Oh wait, I forgot that part. So I mean, he's just used to that. I think in pictures sometimes, and so my brain goes off on a tangent and forgets what the punchline was. But he didn't say a thing. He's like, that's a great idea, hon. Go do that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
He didn't tell me he didn't think I could, and I am grateful he didn't. So, you know, find the people who you want, because it's a long road. It really is. And, you know, for some it's shorter. If it works out that way, amen. If not, you know.
That is so cool. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Everyone's different.
I think that's all the questions we had. Is there anything you want to add or throw out there?
Well, if you want to find me, I'm at Helen Hansen, Hanson. I'm everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, although I hate Twitter. I'm there anyway, but it's 140 characters, seriously. people want to join my readers list, I give away a free thriller at HelenHanson.com.
Awesome.
Yeah, awesome. And what is the audio book clip? What story is that?
Oh, that's going to be, the audio clip is going to be chapters 1 and 2 of Three Lies. We also have the book after Three Lies, which is The Master's Key. That one's out in Audible as well. And the third book in the series, Dead Storm, will be done before Christmas.
Perfect.
We'll finish with that right now. So, all right. The trilogy will be out in a box set at some point too before Christmas.
Oh wow. Awesome. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you for your time. Oh.
It won't be my voice. My voice is kind of low for a female. I've been accused of being a male on the phone a few times.
Oh,
but Patrick does a fabulous job with Patrick Nolan is his name. He does a fabulous job with all the accents. So
we'll miss the animal sounds.
funny. So,
well, I've had people say, can I speak with the lady at the house? I say, no, she's not here. See ya.
That's funny. All right. Well, awesome. Yeah, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I do recommend checking out her writing, even if it's off genre for you. Because of the way she writes and she pushes language for any writer, I do recommend reading her work and kind of looking at how she works with the language there, because I do think it's very unique, and a lot of times it tends to work really well. So yeah, if you're interested, go hit up her website. And, you know, you can pick up one of her books for free and get on the mailing list. Or, like I said, I've been reading Three Lies, and I recommend it. It's very well written. So.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. So that was Helen Hansen. Thanks for listening to our interview with her. We'd just like to invite you to go to startwriting.space to follow our podcast. And you'll see our novel edits on there, too. Also, please, if you have questions, thoughts, comments of any sort, you can reach us at pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. And if you are an author who would like to be interviewed, get in touch with us, because we would love to talk with you about writing and your craft. So thanks for listening.
Yep.
Three Lies, a Master's Thriller, the Master's CIA Thriller Series, Book 1. Written by Helen Hansen. Narrated by Patrick Nolan. Chapter 1. The water bead on her chest slaloms south to join the others on the black diamond run to her groin. Beth Sutton wrapped a thick white towel around her dripping hair. Both hung to her hip. As she stepped onto the bath mat, the arterial catheter bounced off her inner thigh muscle. She wiped down the rest of her body and draped the towel on the rack. Clint left her house at 11 the night before with a promise to return for breakfast prior to their fishing trip. Another evening absorbed in unguarded conversation. Their 2 months together passed with an easy contentment. She should have dialyzed last night, but she'd fallen asleep too soon, cocooned in fading dreams, down in enchantment. The evening proved too satisfying to interrupt for blood filtering. He'd offered to help, again. Maybe he could really handle it. Maybe not. Maybe she wasn't ready to test him. A knock came from her door as she dressed. 6:15. He was early. Once over in the mirror, baggy pink jeans and a pink thermal shirt sufficed for cooking breakfast. Omelets. Everybody liked omelets. She hustled to the door. The deadbolt resisted. Just a second. The lock popped. She threw the door open with a flourishing smile. Her chest inflated with fear. A stocky man wearing a blue ski mask shoved her inside. He covered her mouth before a scream loosened. A piece of paper dropped from his hand. Footsteps fell behind her. She struggled, but she couldn't escape his grip. A sharp jab pierced her bottom. Her pulse staggered. A needle. Oh, dear God. Dreaminess surged. Her focus failed. Clint was coming. He'd stop them. Maybe Clint would prefer waffles. Last night was lovely. Chapter 2. According to Paige Masters, Clint's almost ex-wife, he never noticed anything. But the white Chevy van pulling out of Beth's road caught his attention. At least the sound of the V8 engine rumbling under the hood did. Between a full size and a mini, that van never left the factory boasting anything larger than a V6. Dull and gutless by reputation, the piece of junk couldn't get jacked during a riot. A throaty roar from the vehicle broke his expectation like a Swedish accent from the lips of a black man. While the kiddies tried to give the illusion of raw power under the hood without the trouble of an actual engine swap, this van camouflaged its strength with exhaust silencers. Sporting rear-wheel drive and a torquey V8, that homely white box could spank a Mustang in a quarter mile. Don't say he didn't notice anything. Hell yes, he noticed. Clint parked his black pickup on the main street of Clement, Massachusetts, but stayed in the cab to finish his coffee while the seaside burg enjoyed the remaining minutes of slumber. He preferred walking down to Beth's house so his black lab, Louie, could sniff the flora on the way.
Beth's road was nearly half a mile long and ran mostly downhill on a headland. It led to four houses and a winery. Each home occupied 5 wooded acres, and the winery 50. If Clint drove down to her house without letting Louis romp, then for the duration of their visit, the young dog would whimper, paw the floor, and sulk. Clint had heard the van coming before it emerged from the patchy fog a car length away. 2 swarthy men stayed behind blue-mirrored sunglasses and red socks ball caps as they crested the hill. Probably a delivery to the winery. In spite of not knowing these men, Clint waved. The men either didn't see him or weren't up for friendly this early. Neither waved back. The van's rear tire spun, searching for a hold in the loose gravel. It lurched onto the roadway, staying long enough for Clint to see a dirty patch of bumper sticker glue in the shape of Australia that adorned the back door. Virginia plates. It roared off toward the highway through the dissipating mist. A beautiful day barely underway. What's the rush? Smell the flowers, will you? He emptied the last of the coffee from his paper cup and tossed it onto the floorboard before getting out of the truck. A glance to his watch showed the time as 6:22. He was early, but extra hungry. Somehow that made up for the early. The oceanside chill receded under the constant gaze of the new sun. He pushed the sleeves of his sweatshirt up to the elbows. Come on, Louis. The glossy black dog bounded from the back seat of the cab. A wag started at the tail and rippled through to the other end of his sleek body. A drooling red tongue flapped amid the pearly whites of his mouth. Good boy. Clint clipped a leash on the leather collar and patted Louis's firm flank. Let's go, Lou. Louis led Clint on a tour of every white oak, sugar maple, and pitch pine before scampering up the porch to Beth Sutton's door. A 19th-century bungalow with the Atlantic Ocean slapping its back, the whole place boasted only 820 square feet. Clint lowered the anchor-shaped knocker onto the strike plate. She would hear the clatter from any room. Echoes settled into silence. He knocked again. No shower noises. Even if she were in there, she'd at least call out and tell him to wait. A growl undulated from Clint's empty stomach. Beth specifically invited him to breakfast. He was early, but she ought to be up by now. He knocked again, louder. Another full minute passed. Clint walked around to the back of the house and rapped on the kitchen door. He peered through a sliver of uncovered windowpane. The hemodialysis machine she'd named Dracula stood sentry at the bedroom wall. The doors to both her bedroom and bath were open. Her vacant computer table occupied the near corner in the still, bathless room. The next round of belly noises came with spikes. He turned around and leaned against the gray clapboard house. He dropped the leash and closed his arms across his chest. Louis ran straight to a cricket hopping near the garage behind the house. He pounced but missed. It jumped out of his reach through a gap in the carriage door. Clint forgot to check for her car. Maybe she went out. The garage door lock dangled from the latch. He pushed the solid door in as much as the latch would allow. Even in the low light, the small utility vehicle was easy to see. Beth probably stayed up late reading again or writing. She owed her editor some chapters, but not until early next month. Maybe she had her treatment. She was due for one yesterday, but he'd stayed late. She said she felt washed out after dialysis. He should have gone home sooner so she was free to dialyze. She wouldn't start a session with him around. It was selfish of him to linger, but time with her dissolved like sugar. Still, leaving a guy outside, a hungry guy. This violates some rule of social etiquette, right, Louis? Louis pawed the ground. Being right didn't fill his belly, and Clint still had to rouse her lovely butt. Damn. Moments like this rubbed. He couldn't call her. He ditched his cell phone along with the rest of his electronic tethers, and he needed to find one at this hour. He was the only one he knew without a cell phone. Dock workers, old ladies walking their ankle biters, certainly all the drivers in all the cars and all the merging lanes of I-93 had one. Hell, even school kids. He could afford one. He just didn't want one. Like so many people, most of that crap was unreliable. Beth's neighbor, Janet Rafferty. She'd let him use the phone. He walked across the street and looked for any sign of activity. If she was working in the kiln, he didn't want to disturb her. The house was quiet, but a glow came from her shop. The next pang hit him harder as the extra-bold French roast etched a hole in his stomach lining. Louis probed a Mayflower cluster when Clint caught the leash and went back to the truck. Louis scrambled into the back seat, and Clint drove off. 35 miles from Boston, the tourist town of Clement had few businesses operating this time of year. Even fewer opened at this hour. Clint decided his best shot was near the freeway. The congregation of trucks outside Maggie May's Bluebird Diner lit his hope. Maggie May was a large, hairy man in his 60s with a round, fleshy face. Clad in a red-striped apron and matching cap, his picture could only be completed with the addition of a burning cigarette dangling from the side of his mouth. Armed with twin decanters of fresh coffee, he made his way around the tables of regulars, chatting up each in turn. A quiet man by diner standards, he gave instructions to the kitchen staff by means of hand gestures, facial expressions, and head movements, a performance Marcel Marceau would have admired. Clint found the payphone by the restrooms, naturally. He dropped in some coins and called Beth. After 4 rings, Beth's voice answered. "Hi, I can't take your call right now. Please leave a message and I'll return it when I can." "Hey, it's me. Pick up the phone." He waited for the click of her receiver, for the happy lilt to her voice when she said his name, for a swift end to his growing sense of loss. "Beth, are you there? We had plans today, remember?" No reply. "I'll try your other phone." He smacked down the receiver. Damn it, they'd made a date. Breakfast was her idea, and she'd promised breakfast would be ready at 6:30 sharp. They'd planned to go fishing for striper and meet up with Abe later. It was nearly 7. Where the hell was she? After digging around his pocket, he came up with more change and placed a call to her cell phone. Voicemail kicked in after 3 rings. "It's me, Clint. I've tried all the numbers I know. I'm going to grab something for us to eat and come back. Hope you're up by then." The clank of dishes rising from the dining room nudged Clint's attention to his hunger. He ordered 4 breakfast burritos and coffee at the counter. He took the to-go bag and drove back to her house. He banged on her front door until his hand hurt. She would have heard that. Fear tiptoed through his veins. If she could. He ran to the kitchen window and peered around the curtain's edge. From here, he could see her bed, and Beth wasn't in it. He moved to another window to check the bath. The shower curtain was pulled back. Unless she was in the tub, she wasn't there either. Calm down. She's in good health, considering. She's not going to keel over from a day's delay in her dialysis. At least that's what she told him. Enough of this. Let's eat. Clint turned on the water spigot long enough to make a puddle for the dog and plopped down on Beth's porch rocker. His long legs draped over a milk can painted with rosebuds, cherry blossoms, and blue hydrangeas that Beth said were the same hue as Clint's eyes. Yeah, sure. He poured salsa from a plastic ramekin onto one burrito and tossed another to Louis. The dog intercepted the package like an NFL cornerback. He hoisted the food around with his teeth, biting it and choking large chunks down his throat. Clint finished his meal and wadded all the trash back in the original bag. He took his boot knife out of the sheath and threw it into a tree. Louis retrieved it. With each toss, the knife stuck where he aimed. The activity helped pass the time and freed his brain for thinking. Interest in the game waned before he'd done any lasting damage to the bark. He stared at Beth's door, but decided against trying again. "It's her turn, huh, Lou?" When he hit the road in front of Beth's, he saw Janet pulling a large box from an old Subaru wagon. He called to her and ran over to the side. "Allow me." "Why, thanks." She hauled out another box. "These go in the shop." She led the way. "I was looking for Beth. Have you seen her this morning?" "No, I've been loading my kiln. What's up?" He stepped into the shop and set the box down. "I was due at her place for breakfast, but she's not around." They returned to the wagon for more boxes. Clint knew Beth hadn't told Janet about the dialysis. Beth preferred to keep some details of her life private. After the continuing saga of Paige, he found such discretion refreshing. They landed the last load into Janet's shop. "Thanks for your help." "If you see Beth, let her know I came by." "Will do." Louis led him back to the truck by the main road for the all-important tree survey. For a dog that lived on a boat, wooded lots represented the ultimate in luxury. Clint loaded Louis in the truck. He threw the bag with Beth's burrito on the floorboard and drove off for home, spinning his rear wheels in the effort. Along the coast road, the surf vibrated with a crystalline sheen. They should have been out there by now, together, he and Beth. He'd never seen a more beautiful woman. Not perfect, but simply enchanting. Oh, hell, admit it, she was perfect. Her bamboo-shoot green eyes sparkled amid her heart-shaped face. Golden tresses cascaded in loose ringlets all the way to her gorgeous butt. Botticelli painted her only in his dreams. But beauty never kept Clint engaged. Not like his buddy Todd. Todd swapped women like designer ties. For Clint, the packaging intrigued, but any genuine gift remained hidden inside. While Beth's illness didn't seem to worry her, it left him unnerved. She loomed fragile, ethereal, a morning mist that might seep through his hand. Like catching a butterfly, then opening your cupped hand slowly to see if it was there. When they were together, he caught himself checking to see if she was still in the room with him. He tousled Louis's furry neck. I've only known her 2 months. Who needs this? Stood up by a damn butterfly. Clint pulled into Clement Marina and parked. Louis stayed on alert while Clint cleaned out the last 2 days' mail from his box. Merlin, one of the Clement Marina staff, walked up to them and sidled in close. Guess what's landed in your slip? What do you mean? Alas, an angelfish. She came looking for you, so I let her in. You let me know if you want to throw her back, mate. I'll get my net. Jungle rhythms pummeled Clint's chest. He wiped sweaty palms down the front of his pants. Where is she? At your boat, Merlin rubbed on his scraggly chin. A real swimmer, that one. Clint threw his backpack over his shoulder and headed to the security gate, down the gangway to his slip at the end of the dock. This time, Louis followed. He looked back at the dog. Why'd she come here? Louis's expression didn't change. Half the damn morning, gone. She knew they were meeting at her house, but he couldn't stay mad because Beth was here, now. He hated this feeling, neediness. It didn't suit him. He didn't want it to suit him. But his relief trumped any anger. She was here now. That was all that mattered. She didn't stand him up. She just changed the plans. She wasn't Beth. Paige Master sat on the port gunwale of Clint's 45-foot sailboat. Even with the expansive view of the harbor, the glorious Atlantic beyond, there she sat filing her acrylic fingernails. I've been trying to reach you. Your cell phone isn't working. She finally looked up at Clint. What's the matter? Can't afford the payments anymore? Her third-grade smile glowed with the intensity of a lighthouse as seen from a battered ship. For a moment, Clint stopped breathing. In less than 5 months, their divorce would be final. Technology and future ex-wives, both highly unreliable.